and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax, and I'm sorry for the apocalypse happening right outside my window at this exact moment.
It's happening outside everybody's window, David. And sometimes the call is coming from inside the house. I'll say that.
Yeah.
And thank you for, I don't know where I am in the intro. So how's it going, David?
I'm good. Do you want to start over?
No, it's fine. It's fine.
It's going well. And we have a guest whom we'll, I think, go ahead and introduce now. Right. Because it's the first, this has become, I'm not sure how many years we've been doing this, but it's become a tradition. The first episode of the new year, or I guess the first episode recorded in the new year. Right. Because our last episode posted in 2022, but the first episode we record in the new year is kind of on the top 10 films as decreed by Battleship Pretension's editor at large, Scott Nye. Scott, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello.
This really does have the feel right now of a Zoom work meeting where you can tell the other person is like doing something else.
Well, I'm trying to get my little list up here, you know. All this content for the people, so I'm switching browsers. I'm approving that it's really me with two-factor authentication.
Sure.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah. I've been that guy in work meetings, and I know that like there are people, like there are times I'm so like, sometimes like there's a work meeting going on and I'll be like catching up on work and I'll be emailing someone that I know is in the meeting with me about something else.
Yes.
but it's just like, I gotta get this done.
Yeah. I occasionally will have like departmental meetings. But the problem with a departmental meeting, at least as far as one of the schools that I teach in, it's not just the cinema department. It's like the entire humanities department. And so I really only need to be there for probably 10 to 15 minutes, if that.
Okay.
The meeting is about 2 hours. And though I'm getting paid for the whole 2 hours, it's just like, wow, I feel like I shouldn't be hearing this. I'm feeling like I'm hearing like the behind the scenes of what they're talking about over in dance. But yeah, and because you are not required in these meetings to have your camera on, beautiful. Now we're talking. So like I mute myself, I turn my camera off. I keep the earbuds in just in case. But yeah, I will do emails. Sometimes I'll just play a game on my phone. Don't tell anybody that I do that.
I mean, I don't know if any of your the people you answer to listen to this podcast. I know that at least one of my bosses does listen to this podcast, but I also feel like I'm not going to get in trouble for copying to doing more work, like
exactly, yes,
working
yes.
while working. It's probably not gonna like come back to bite me. Okay, hopefully we've vamped long enough that Scott has been able to get his affairs in order. But I also, first, before we get into the episode and the topic, which I've already spoiled, usually I wait till after we get into it to say what the topic is, but anyway, we do want to acknowledge that as of today, the day of this recording, Peter Bogdanovich has passed away.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is kind of like morbid, but off like as our profile episodes for the past few years have turned into like tributes, you know, and retrospectives and things like that. So sometimes when a major figure dies, I think like we should do an episode about that. My first reaction when I heard that Peter Bogdanovich died was, I was like, have we done a Peter Bogdanovich episode? I feel like we've talked about his movies, especially our personal favorites of his movies being like, What's Up Doc, Last Picture Show, and probably Cat's Meow. So often in this podcast that I actually had to look to make sure we hadn't already done a Bogdanovich profile episode. And I think that speaks to how much his work meant to us. Not just, here I am listing off his directorial efforts, but he was also he was a writer. He was also an actor in a lot of things, especially, I mean, you know, Natalie and I are always in the process of rewatching The Sopranos. So we've seen him as Elliot Kupferberg as recently as just a few days ago. And I feel like that his tendency to direct, you know, narrative films, direct documentaries, to show up as a writer of books as well as screenplays, and to pop up in other people's things, to devote so much of his time to The Other Side of the Wind seeing the light of day. Like, yeah. I think it really speaks to not just, we can talk, and we probably will do a profile on him at some point in which we will talk about his skills as a filmmaker. But I think as a champion of cinema, as a devotee of cinema, and as a collaborator, I think it really, those are the things that I think of when I think of him as someone who was willing to pitch in and show up and advocate and do what he could for great movies, whether they were his or someone else's, and great TV like The Sopranos.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think, there are a number of films of his that I really love. I don't remember if you mentioned Paper Moon. That's one that I really enjoy as well. Yeah.
Noises Off was a huge, so like teenage, like theater teen. Sure. Like when I was a theater teen, Noises Off was a big favorite. I haven't seen it in over 20 years, but I'm sure it holds up.
I imagine it probably does. Yes.
Yeah. It's one of, maybe my favorite John Ritter performance, which is saying something.
That is tough. That's really tough because I do love him in Bad Santa, but I love him in Sling Blade as well. Yeah, he's a great actor. But that's the other thing, as you mentioned, Bogdanovich as an actor, and you know, we think of him as being our age. You know, when we see something like The Sopranos, like, oh, he's sort of this monotone kind of guy. You go back and watch The Other Side of the Wind, and he's great. Like, he's this young guy and he has like a lot of energy, and you really get a strong sense of his character. Like, he really, it's so interesting to think that he could have gone that way almost exclusively and probably done okay as a comedic actor.
If you're talking about his performance as Elliot Kupferberg on The Sopranos as anything other than comedic, we're watching different shows.
Yeah. And I think that also speaks to his ability, again, as an actor, and probably because he's a director, he's able to see, okay, how do I read on screen? I think I got it. I read boring and monotone and self-absorbed a little bit. And but then obviously being the Welles fan that I am, I did read his, I read This Is Orson Welles, which is like interviews with him and with Bogdanovich and Welles and stuff. But then I also read his very long essay in response to Pauline Kael's Raising Cain. And it is this full throated defense, not merely of, yes, Orson Welles, someone that he's friends with, but it's like, oh, well, it clearly frustrated him to see someone take such a sloppy approach to like film scholarship. It's not merely her opinion, that's fine, but it's her like printing rumors and basically as fact. And then he goes and does the research that she didn't. And it really, you can get a sense of like righteous indignation, but still a certain degree of civility. And yes, admittedly, there's occasionally a moment of cattiness, but whatever, it's against Pauline Kael. She could be pretty catty herself. So I agree with you. I think in many ways, he just was devoted to film as an art form, whether it be as a critic, as a director, as an actor, just, he was always celebrating film, and it was really, it's unfortunate that he's gone.
Yeah. He's really I think the only American director I can think of who took up like the French New Wave model of, okay, I'm going to write criticism, then I'm going to go into film, but I'll keep writing criticism. I mean, I'm looking at his works list and he wrote over a dozen books, participated in over a dozen commentary tracks on movies that weren't his at all, plus made, you know, multiple Oscar nominated and winning films. It's an astounding career. And I will say, if you guys want a guest on any future profile of him, certainly keep old Scott in mind.
We will, presumptuous of you, but yeah.
my big, some of the, because in preparation, if we do a profile, I'll want to watch a lot of the films that I haven't seen. A lot of the big ones aren't streaming. A lot of the big ones I haven't seen, at least, aren't streaming. Mask is not anywhere. Texas Phil's not anywhere. And They All Laughed is not anywhere. I don't know
Well, sure. If you view streaming as the be all end all of film,
is there any other, is there anything else?
Well, I could, I mean, if I could, I don't want to, I guess I'm opposed to, like, I don't like blind buying, so I don't want to buy. I don't like the idea of buying something I haven't seen. If I can rent it from the library on the, on a disc, I will do that. But I don't know. And maybe, and this is like bit me before, you know, when I, when we did that Christopher Plummer episode, there's like a, there's a HBO like made for TV movie, like Walter Winchell biopic that Christopher Plummer, he doesn't play Winchell. He plays somebody else in it, but I was like, oh, it's not streaming anywhere. I could also buy a DVD for $1.50 on the internet, but I just like on principle, I don't like to blind buy stuff. Maybe I'll have to like break that rule for yeah, they all left.
You buy it, take down to Amoeba next time you're there. There you one go. And okay. Done.
Well, before we move on, I do want to share my one Bogdanovich in the Wild story that I have. Many summers ago, Natalie and I were in line in the courtyard outside the Billy Wilder Theater for a screening of So This Is Paris with live accompaniment. And Peter Bogdanovich, I turned around, Natalie and I were talking, I turned around and Peter Bogdanovich is standing right behind me, ascot and everything, you know. It's also, I mentioned summer on purpose because it's literally like, it's like 105 degrees this day. And so we're waiting, like they haven't opened the box office yet. And at one point I just see Peter Berlanger walk past me, just walk into the lobby, which is not officially open, but I'm guessing he decided, I'm Peter fucking Bogdanovich and I'm 75 years old and let's stand around in this heat. So he just walked in and waited inside when they hadn't let anybody in.
It's like, oh, my neckerchief is soaked with sweat.
Yeah, yeah.
Is he going short sleeve ascot? Do you have a full jacket?
I think he had a jacket. I think he had a jacket, yeah.
Classy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I also, I guess we should mention that Sundance in person was canceled.
I just saw that. And yeah. Is that, because you were you both going to go? I forget.
No, I haven't gone in years. I haven't been able to.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, yeah, I was going to go in the sense that I had lodging arranged and a flight and transportation to and from the Salt Lake City airport to Park City. I had everything in place. I was already considering not going because of Omicron anyway. So Sundance kind of like made the decision for me. And luckily I was able to get, well, nothing's come through yet, but I'm told I'll be able to get refunds on everything, which I mean, Tyler, Battleship Retention will be refunded because Battleship Retention paid for all that stuff.
Oh, yes.
You'll get a flight credit and you'll like it.
they said it'll be so yeah, not that I don't work for JetBlue or anything, but JetBlue said I could get a refund. If that comes through, good for JetBlue. Anyway, so let's, before we move on, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I use them each and every day of our lives. I will say, I always like hesitate. What am I going to talk about that I listen to? What I've been listening to, this feels stupid because sometimes, so I have like an ongoing playlist on Spotify that like, as I hear about new music or as something comes up, I add to it. And so, but because of like the holidays, I wasn't spending as much time listening like I do it at work. So I'm kind of, my playlist is backlog. So I'm listening to stuff that I put on my playlist in like mid December, which is weird. Like I was exercising this morning and suddenly like I'm listening to Bing Crosby ask, do you hear what I hear? And I'm like, this is too late. But I say all this to point out that I listened yesterday and today, I listened to a lot of songs by Draco, the Ruler, the rapper who was killed on December. It was like 19th or something shortly before Christmas, killed like backstage at a festival here in Los Angeles. It's terrible. He was a sort of no one else really sounded like him as a, you know, not that there's not like that East Coast, West Coast thing like there was when we were kids, but as like an LA rapper, he was one of the like, I think most respected and most exciting names in rap in the city. So it's very sad to have lost him when he was really, I think, starting to blow up outside of people who know a lot about rap, like in more mainstream, like crossover. I mean, this festival was like had Snoop Dogg on it and stuff. Snoop Dogg didn't perform because they stopped the festival after after Draco was murdered. But very sad. But it did sound great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds, and they're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back, and let's get into it, shall we?
Indeed.
Scott, take it away. You're going to do your top your best films of the year, right?
Yeah, and I'm gonna just turn my screen off and my mic off. Don't yeah, I'm still totally paying attention.
Yeah, so we usually get into starting at the worst of the year. I think I'm gonna abstain from that this year, mainly because the past year has been so rough for the movies. Well, the past 2 years, really, not in terms of quality of the content, as the kids like to term it, but in terms of just the infrastructure of their future existence. You know, when I look at thinking about like what is the worst film of the year, I try to think about movies that I really hated sitting through, and I really regretted like the time and effort and minutes of my life feeling like years draining away from it. But I didn't have that experience this year. I was genuinely glad to be watching even some of the lesser films this year. So I found it hard to really hate anything. So I'll move right to the overrated.
I'll send you a list. Don't
okay,
you
great.
Worry.
I mean, I am getting better about filtering out movies I yeah. know I don't want to see. I think I used to just go see movies, you know, I'll see whatever, but increasingly. And it's also like, I don't want to pick on, you know, the few small movies I saw that were really dreadful.
Yeah, that's the thing with me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I still see a lot of crap because I think I still take more like,
yeah,
I review more stuff and like take more bum assignments, I think. So yeah, I definitely have some, but we'll get to mine in a couple months.
Yeah, I mean, I usually look for like big blockbuster stuff I hated or Oscar buzzy stuff that was dreadful, but no real huge regrets this year, so that's okay with me. I'll move right into the overrated category, which a film that I good, maybe not as good as, you know, I have heard or the general impression seems to be. Going with an David, do you have a question?
No, sorry, you froze up for a second.
Oh, I'm yeah. sorry. Shoot. Are no, you still hearing me okay?
It's recorded fine. It usually okay. does.
Yes, it usually does.
All right. So overrated pick, going with James Wan's Malignant, which I think is a good deal of fun. So everyone was talking about it. They're like, all right, James Wan has lost his shit. Dude's cashing in his checks after making WB billions of dollars. He is, you know, doing the one for me. The last 30 minutes are absolutely crazy. And most of this film is pretty absolutely crazy and a great, terrific, I think very fruitful waste of studio resources in terms of like building whole sets just to accomplish single shots, you know, all that stuff that like Brian De Palma made his career on, and which increasingly, you know, people are less and less willing to pay for, but here he's really milking it for everything it's worth. And there's a lot of really fun filmmaking, I think, especially the first 2/3. Then there's this whole like third act revelation, which is indeed completely batshit insane and one of the least expected and possibly like most deranged story beats I've seen in a mainstream movie in a while. But the filmmaking itself kind of deteriorates after that and starts looking cheap. And so much of the movie, I was like, this does not look like a cheap movie. They're really going out for it. But then it just kind of deteriorates into simple like chase films and simple fight stuff. And the last act where the story was ramping up into complete insanity, the filmmaking was ramping down into pretty tepid VOD style stuff. So I came away feeling it was a little overrated. For my underrated pick this year, I'm going with Tom McCarthy's Stillwater, which I understand people's objections to it. If you're like taking Amanda Knox aside, for example, I do probably even agree that it's maybe exploitative of her story, because it's essentially, it's a story of a college age girl who goes to jail for allegedly killing her roommate. She claims she didn't do it, et cetera, et cetera. Very much bears the broad similarity to the Amanda Knox story. So if people are concerned with that, I get it. If people are concerned with the fact that it sympathizes with what is clearly a Trump supporter in this, the year of our Lord 2021, I understand there's some hesitancy around that. I'm saying for me, in terms of the stuff I get off on, which is like deeply conflicted protagonist who keeps making life worse for himself, super ace performance by Matt Damon, and an ending that I think, rather than sympathize necessarily with him, shows the way that, you know, certain people maybe have certain inclinations towards certain fascist figures, end up digging themselves a hole, and in their efforts to strong arm their way into a better life or to fix their problems, are in fact making things worse for themselves and a great deal of others. So I found it a really morally complex and really conflicted and really refreshing and super engaging film. And it's a shame that it's been kind of passed aside for one reason or another.
Yeah, I wish I'd seen Malignant or Stillwater. They're both on my to watch list. I probably am gonna follow the hype and put Malignant a little higher on my to watch list before we get to our top 10. But Stillwater is on my to watch list. But I have the longest to watch list I've ever made in like the days leading up, the months leading up to our top 10. So I'm not gonna get to all this stuff. So
it's also a long as hell film. It's almost 2.5 hours.
It's so interesting. Because, and I guess maybe it just speaks to, and this is something David has said, that like just operating different parts of the internet. Like, I don't think, I haven't seen Malignant, but I don't think of it as like rated highly at all. Like a lot of people went, like whether on Facebook or Twitter, not that I'm a part of film Twitter or anything like that, but like when it came out, so many people, they said it was crazy. Some people in an admiring kind of way, but most people were like, this thing is just a mess. This thing is like, there, like, I think of it as a film that is not well regarded.
Yeah. I double checked and it has mostly positive reviews.
Okay.
And at least the people I, you know, the feed I've curated over the years, certainly very enthusiastic about it.
I like that you folded your hands in front of your face as you said that, because it was very supervillain-esque.
Well,
like, the feed that I've curated over time by killing the people I disagree with. Anyway, sorry.
I was mostly trying to hide a burp, but I'm glad it came across.
Most Blofeld often was trying to hide a burp.
You gotta remain intimidating when you're picking on James Bond. And then I always like to pick out some honorable mentions, stuff that I wouldn't really,
something I've seen. I feel bad. Like,
oh, there's a couple in here you've seen for sure. Okay. I usually like to pick out a handful of films that I wouldn't really consider for my top 10 for one reason or another, but were still notable and effective. And in this case, I went with five films that are kind of very much tackling internet life and how I'd say the long-term effects of internet on society, on people's psychology, on the ways that we kind of form our self impressions, and in some ways how much easier it's been to kind of control independent thought through like the repetition of pervasive media that goes on through the internet. I think these are necessarily messy films. You know, they're tackling what is a very present and contemporary subject, and which we are not at all resolved on. You know, I mean, part of my frustration to them is period pieces. It feels like filmmakers are just trying to look for something they can see it whole. Whereas in a contemporary film, you know, they're really trying to wrestle with the moment, and they might not get it right. They might get it wrong. Really, time will be the tell. So these are films that could very well, you know, be considered some of the best of the year later on. Most notably, I picked out The Scary of 61st, which is a sort of hipster horror film that's completely insane and weird and amateurish and maybe bad or maybe great. I really couldn't tell you for sure, but is really, really fresh and invigorating in that same vein. Same thing as that.
That one's on my to watch list somewhere in between Malignant and Stillwater.
Fair enough. It is much shorter than both of those. So yeah, okay. It's got that going for it. Also PVT Chat, which didn't get a ton of notice, was about, it stars Julia Fox as sort of a cam girl and a man who relentlessly pursues her and is deeply uncomfortable. More famously, I think more people are familiar with Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn,
right.
Which is this year's great COVID movie. In addition to being a reflection on general fascist tendencies worldwide, A Glitch in the Matrix by a friend of the show, Rodney Asher. And I think we talked about it on our Best of the Year So Far episode.
Yeah, it was on my top five of the year so far.
Okay, yeah, then listeners are probably at least familiar with that. But yes, super interesting documentary. I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but it's really invested in the subject.
Do you
really
think... That's weird. I always agree with everything Rodney puts in his documentaries.
But I don't know. I mean, agree with... Are you saying agree with the movie? Because I don't know that the movie... In my experience of the movie is not that it really settles on a point of view. It presents a lot of other people, but I felt like it was letting you make up your mind. I don't know. I can disagree with the people in the movie. I don't know what the movie had set. I don't know if the movie landed on.
No, that's fair. Agree with is the wrong word. I think there's a sense in which the movie is more for people who don't have a pretty good familiarity with simulation theory in general. And so there was a lot of the movie where it was like, yep, I know. Let's next point. Keep going. So that's probably more what I meant. And then finally, Lana Wachowski's The Matrix Resurrections, which is just a stellar piece of filmmaking all around. Super wild, super shooting for the fences. And it's great to see that kind of both ambition and lack of refinement in a studio film that feels like it really just came from a single person.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I haven't seen, like I said, I haven't seen Malignant yet, but I was thinking about Matrix Resurrections when you were talking about a director just spending the studio's money, you know, and it feels like, it's Lana, not Lily, right? Who directed it? Lana. Making a Matrix film, but also trading off the Matrix, Legacy, which I'm sure will be the name of some movie at some point, to get to play in a very, very expensive and big sandbox.
Well, and I think it really gets at, like I said, kind of the way corporations view internet access as a way to kind of control the populace. I think there's a lot that gets said by, I guess I shouldn't reveal too much, but one of the villainous characters about the way they're using the Matrix to kind of control people and how they don't really need the same kind of illusions as before. They just need like an outlet for people.
Yeah. There are, I could talk about two of the movies you mentioned and one you haven't mentioned yet, but might be in your top 10. I keep thinking of movies that are better than Don't Look Up in terms of like speaking to our moment, sure, you know, yeah. And yeah, Bad Luck Banging, is definitely a much better, like angrier and but less like self congratulatory look at the sort of devolution of public conversations. And then there's another one that I'm not gonna mention it because it might be in your top 10.
Yeah, I mean, Bad Luck Banging certainly takes it to the point where, like, even the anger is ridiculous.
Yeah.
The last, like, few minutes of that film are completely, like...
So fun.
Alienating to everybody, including maybe the filmmaker themselves. It's like...
Yeah.
I can't imagine him watching that back and be like, ah, yes, nailed it.
Well, yeah, after the movie ropes him in with the opening few minutes.
Well, sure, yeah. But I'm saying that's, like, kind of, like, I think... But- It's just setting up
Tyler's kind
of
porn. It opens with porn, just so you know. Yeah,
it opens with peace. I think that's more like pointedly confrontational in terms of like, this is the kind of movie it is. This is what we're talking about. Deal with it or not. Whereas the ending is like just letting it rip and just almost embarrassing himself in terms of how understandably angry he is about it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I really loved that movie. Expect to hear more about that in our coming months of coverage.
Right on. All right. So I think that's all the miscellany I wanted to get out of the way before getting into the top 10 itself. Yeah, have a lot of stuff that I considered for the number 10 spot. I was literally trading out two films in this spot all day today. So by the time I post the published version of this list, you know, who knows, might change by that. But for now, for today, for tonight, I'm saying number 10 is Francois Ozon's Summer of 85. I've been a big old fan of Francois Ozon for past 10 years. I still need to catch up with a lot of his earlier work, but I think he's really one of the weirdly least sung and finest filmmakers working today. He takes on a ton of genres. I think, I mean, part of his problem might be that he works too much. He's made like 19 films over the past 20 years or something like that. And all of them in different genres. You know, there's not a lot of consistency that people tend to look for and hope for in terms of like auteurist work. But this, I think, is really his, at least the best film of his that I've seen. It's about a young boy, about 16, who meets another boy a couple of years older than him one summer in 1985. Fun fact about that, Francois Ozon adapted this from a novel that was published in 1982. He updated it to be in 1984 when he was 16 to mirror his protagonist, and then wanted to use a song by The Cure, but they were like, no, you can't use that. That song didn't come out till 1985. So he's like, well, I guess I'll set it in 1985.
Wow.
So that's why it takes place then, because he wanted to use this one song, and you know, it's a good song. I get it. And so these two boys meet, start to form a sort of relationship and sexual relationship, and fall into a sort of kind of love. It has very much the auspices of, you know, a Call Me By Your Name. You know, I think a lot of the aesthetic choices draw that association pretty cleanly. But at the same time, this is a much less tender relationship between the two of them. It's much more combative and much more uncertain, and all of which gets it to a place where by the time it does become very tender, it's much less expected. And the way in which it takes on kind of that earnestness is, I mean, it's a very Francois Ozon choice, even though it's adapted straight from the novel. I can see why he attached himself to it. But it's a very kind of subversive look that really connects. This is really taken from an interview I read with him, but it really connects the issue of gayness in the 80s with its direct connection to death with the rise of AIDS. You know, the film doesn't directly tackle AIDS, but it ties the two together in a way, homosexuality and death, in a way that was very pertinent, you know, in the 80s, in a way that isn't as much today. And it also carries with it a certain, not that it like is at all homophobic or at all like damning of the kids, but it recognizes that for the 1980s, any sort of homosexuality was very taboo. I think a lot of filmmakers today, when they make gay films, it's very much like a post, I don't know, what would you say? Like post gay marriage equality, love is love, everyone's equal kind of thing. But to go post back to
Will and Grace.
Sure. Yeah. To go back to this time when, you know, a lot of people felt bad for being gay. And it's not that the characters necessarily feel guilt, but they feel a certain place in society that is removed from all others. Some of this is played for comedy. You know, their parents keep making up excuses like they're fighting over some girl when really they're fighting over each other. And so there's a certain like blindness that people have to the fact that they even could be gay, which is kind of amusing. But yeah, really impressive, really beautifully shot film. And yeah, that's my number 10.
I loved it too. Obviously, by my rules, it's a 2020 film. But I, like you, have long been a Francois Ozon fan, going back to Under the Sand from 1999. But I probably would have, no, that's 2000. Maybe I saw it in 2000 in the theater when I was like still very like young and new to like seeing current world cinema in a theater, and under the Sand blew me away. But then it'll always be Swimming Pool for me as the big one. And not just, I used to have a Swimming Pool t-shirt that I got as a video store manager. it said Swimming Pool like on DVD and VHS on whatever date, and I used to sleep in it. But yeah, I also really loved Summer of 85. I think like the Call Me By Your Name references, or not references, but the similarity is like the film's Ozon can't not be aware of.
I mean, he's a very postmodern director in general. Yeah. So it's, I think, a welcome comparison.
He also, the movie was also, I can't remember if you said this, but it was shot on 16 millimeter film.
Yeah.
Now I saw it, you know, on a screener, and I have since got the Blu-ray, which I haven't watched yet. But it, that, that texture feels like a connection to the past in a way, like for a period film.
Yeah. There's been a real rise of shooting period pieces on 16 over the past decade. And I am deeply in favor of it. Always looks good.
Okay.
All right. Number nine is Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Lost Daughter, which I wasn't really expecting to necessarily love. I mean, I really like Maggie Gyllenhaal as an actor. I had no reason to expect her directorial debut would be anything less than stellar. But at the same time, I think I share your guys' suspicion about actors turned directors. And I think just with debut features in general, I notice that they tend to focus a lot of energy on a couple of actors, and anyone else who floats to the film tends to feel like they're just like, yeah, just say the lines, you'll be fine. But here she really invests like every corner of the frame with a lot of life, a lot of texture to it. It's about a woman who goes on vacation, and played by Olivia Colman, goes on vacation, meets a family multi-generational family. They're out there kind of on a family trip. It's suggested, at least I got the impression, that they have some ties to some sort of like organized crime situation. But for the most part, she just sees in each of them kind of different phases of her life and different avenues she could have gone down, different avenues she is glad she didn't go down. Especially surrounding the issue of motherhood. And as we find out through flashbacks, Olivia Colman's character is played by Jesse Buckley in those flashbacks. Her character, I should her name, Lita is her character's name. Lita felt a lot of regret about being a mother, and a lot of regret she handled the first few years of her children's lives. And you can understand why. This is not a film that sentimentalizes parenthood at all. It looks like complete hell from top to bottom. Kids are always screaming anytime she's trying to do the slightest thing. And she's trying to build an academic career at the same time as raising her kids, and they're constantly interrupting it. She can't get any space to herself because her husband assumes that she'll just do all the work with the kids, and she has no room to kind of grow into her own person. And the way the flashbacks are handled, and especially the way I think the present stuff is handled, I didn't have to look at the book, which of course Netflix in their mini swag boxes throughout the years sent the novel along with their Lost Daughter box. I didn't have to look at the novel to guess that it was written in the first person. Maggie Gyllenhaal does such an exceptional job of giving us a point of view without doing any sort of voiceover, without having the shots narrated in any way or clarified in any way. You can just see by the way that Olivia Colman is seeing them through our vision of it through the camera, you can see how she's thinking about these people. And even if you can't necessarily verbalize it in a way, this is really the most refreshing thing about it, is there's no like dictation about how specifically that's being read. You can just tell it's coming from a personal perspective that's maybe a little bit anxious, a little bit paranoid, a little bit judgmental, but also a little bit envious. There's a lot of really mixed emotions going on with some camera work that, you know, on paper could seem very scattered. It's all kind of handheld and just catching moments, stray moments here and there. But the way it's kind of built together in the editing, it was edited by actually the guy who done most of Todd Haynes' films, including, I think, pertinent to this, Carol and Mildred Pierce, other films about motherhood, among other things. And yeah, I mean, the way it all just comes together is really exceptional. I think this is as good as Olivia Colman's performances as I've ever seen. Definitely the same for Jesse Buckley and Dakota Johnson, who plays one of the family members. And yeah, I was just completely enraptured by it and really refreshed to see this kind of point of view taken, where it's not all about how great parenthood is, how valuable motherhood is in terms of a woman's life, how conflicted it is about all the different things people and women especially want with their lives.
A couple of things. Weirdly, kind of relating to what we were saying about Peter Bogdanovich being funny on The Sopranos. The Lost Daughter is not a comedy, but Olivia Colman is such a funny actress that I often found myself laughing at some of her, like, the way she acts things out, or certain line readings. But what I really wanted to get into is, you talked about her, the movie, like, being in the first person and her point of view and the way that she can be judgmental. And I think she can definitely be judgmental. And I think the movie sympathizes with her from her point of view, but also I don't think the movie feels as judgmental towards these people.
No, not at all.
She does. And I liked that, given that. So Lita often comes across, you know, she could be prickly. She often comes across as something, as someone a little bit like unpleasant in some ways. But I also think, as the intellectual surrounded by like these, you know, whatever the Greek version of like, you know, Guidos is essentially, you know, like these uncultured, but like, you know, new money, people, her judgment of them. I feel like I sound like I'm being judgmental, but I think I'm doing that to kind of take on her point of view, the way that she judges these people, I think, and given the potential type of audience for a movie like The Lost Daughter, I think she often comes across looking worse, and in a way that I wonder if I don't know. We tend to use that phrase like to feel seen as being like a good thing,
sure.
But I think there's a bad way to feel seen, and I think that like the worst, the less appealing, less forgiving, less humanistic qualities of Leda might make the likely audience from a movie like The Lost Daughter feel seen in a way that might be a little uncomfortable. You know, there's a scene in the movie in which she freaks out at a bunch of like young men who aren't being quiet in a movie theater, and that's like, oh, but it isn't wish fulfillment. Like, I'm the kind of person who's like, oh, I'd love to yell at a bunch of,
yeah, right.
but she just comes across looking like the crazy lady.
Yes, that's how you come across when you yell at young people in a movie theater, and then you're the one that has to leave.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I also loved The Lost Daughter, and I'm glad I didn't read the novel, because Natalie read the novel, and when I started telling her about the movie, she was like, oh, that sounds bad. I don't care. I don't, because they change certain superficial things about it. But then I've also seen people on Twitter who read the novel say, like, I'm having trouble liking this movie as much as other people do. But that's often been my case. If I read a novel too shortly before seeing the movie doesn't feel right to me. And it took me a long time to realize how good LA Confidential was, because I literally like finished reading the book and was like, all right, time to go rent the movie. And like watched that night. I was like, what am I watching? This is not,
what is this horseshit?
Yeah, exactly.
I think I've mentioned before that, one of my little side gigs is as a script consultant. And, there have been instances where someone says like, oh, I'm adapting this book, and sometimes it's like a book they wrote or you know, a lesser known novel or whatever, and like I can send, you know, like I have a PDF of that, and like you can read that as well. And I said like, no, yeah. I really don't want to.
Yeah,
that will only ruin this for me. And then really it's just me saying like, how close do you want to be to the novel? And that's really not the point of it. It's a different medium.
Yeah, one of the interesting changes, the book is by an Italian author, I think it was set in Italy. It was going to be set in New Jersey, but then I can't remember if it was for a pandemic reason or financial reason, they couldn't get that location. And so they're like, well, Greece will work. And so they just moved the whole thing to Greece. And weirdly, it totally works. It's a great little portrait of Greece. All right. Okay. My number eight. So very excitingly, my number eight is the first film on this that at one point was my favorite film of the year. It doesn't mean that every film after this, you know, bumped it off necessarily, but that just shows, I think it was a really strong year that there were enough films that eventually edged out what at one point was my favorite film of the year, which came on the second half of the year. Even it was Paul Schrader's The Card Counter. Saw this opening weekend, couldn't wait for it, was super excited for it. I liked First Reformed enough, but it didn't. Maybe it's just that it's so derivative of Winter Light, and me being a huge Bergman head, I was a little bit like, come on, Schrader, get your own ideas. But I think this film is a much stranger film, a much more aggressive one, and has less kind of, you know, First Reform has very explained characters who have very straightforward motivations at any given moment. And you can understand moment to moment why they're reacting the way they are to given situations. Card Counter is a little more unwieldy. It starts out with the kind of the architecture that could lend itself to very straightforward motivations, where Oscar Isaac plays a compulsive gambler who's kind of using gambling as a way to at once both punish himself and kind of shut out his memories of being a prison guard. I never know if I'm pronouncing this right. Abu Ghraib?
Abu Ghraib?
Abu Ghraib?
Abu Ghraib.
That's how I'm good at it.
A prison guard there, and his role in the ensuing scandal, that he was one of the guards, you know, in those famous photographs, and by all means did everything that those photographs suggested. And the flashbacks to those are straight up nightmares. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing when the camera switched to that insane aesthetic. And I think put off a number of people in the theater both times I went to see it. They're all like, what is happening? But I was like, yes, this is what I'm here for. This is the strange, weird Paul Schrader shit that I absolutely love. And as the film goes on, it becomes, it turns, you know, slightly romantic. He forms a sort of relationship with Tiffany Haddish, who plays a woman who has kind of a gambling corral. You know, she represents a financial backer who will stake skilled poker players to play in games, and they'll get a cut of the winnings, et cetera, et cetera. It sort of forms a business out of it. And the relationship they form is like very tender, but there's still this element of the film that's ticking away and leading us to not really trust Oscar Isaac's motivations, or if he is even able to form proper motivations given his history. And I really, I mean, above, not necessarily above all else, but I was sort of amused and impressed that they released this on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. It's such a damning indictment of the legacy that the country has built over the past 20 years, all the violence that it's spawned and all the complicity in that violence that it's encouraged. The fact that a guy like Oscar Isaac's character is just roaming free these days is pretty damning in and of itself, and really shows how someone like that, you know, just because they've completed their prison sentence doesn't mean they have it all figured out, that they're still making the same sort of mistakes as they go along. Between the film being shot in 1:6:6:1, which is, you know, the art house ratio, and the score by Robert Levin Bean, who's Michael Bean's son. Michael Bean did the music for Paul Schrader's great film, Light Sleeper. Music is very much similar in that realm. So between those two elements, the film kind of had me from the jump and just kept impressing me as it went along.
Yeah, I also liked it more than First Reformed, and I loved First Reformed as well. But it has a similar thing to First Reformed and to a lot of Paul Schrader's work, I think, of being a political movie about like institutional culpability for these sorts of things, at the same time being a very personal movie about a man wrestling with his guilt and how the things that he's done have irrevocably altered who he is. And it's both those things at the same time, and they're not necessarily harmonious elements. They're often working together. I think that's what you mentioned sure. Being weird. I think that's kind of where the weirdness comes from, is that like almost like what's it called when like two magnets when they're, you put them and they try to push away from each other, that a lot of the movie feels like, is it trying to say, 'cause you've got the one character, it's Ty Sheridan,
right? Yeah.
Who clearly believes that like, okay, the higher ups are responsible for this. And Oscar Isaac, who's like taking his personal responsibility on himself. And there's, you see that push and pull, throughout the movie. Yeah. I also loved the guard counter.
Excellent. Number seven is, Ryosuke Hamaguchi's Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. Drive My Car is not on my top 10 list. I liked it a lot, but for me, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy was really, speaking to me on a much grander level. So Hamaguchi's a fascinating director. I first got introduced to him through his 5-hour film, Happy Hour. And then Drive My Car is a 3-hour film. Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy is a 2-hour film that has 3 stories in it. So he is very loose in terms of what he feels is appropriate movie length and appropriate length for a story. And refreshingly, these are stories that really talk to each other without being like directly overlapping or anything. You could very well view them separately, but I think the ways they work together are very wise and measured and very attuned and refreshing. The first story, I don't want to give away anything about too much of them, because there's some very clever kind of twists of sorts or reversals or reveals that happen in the course of them. The first story is essentially about two women who have very different perceptions of a single man and the way those kind of play out over the course of a night or two. The second story is about a student who convinces his lover to fake a sex scandal with a professor who's failing him, and the way that all three of their relationships evolve over a short period of time. And then the third story, the one that I think has gotten the most acclaim, understandably, is about two women who meet randomly and recognize each other from high school. They're all sort of about people playing certain roles and how the way others, I think, perceive us changes the way we behave in certain circumstances. So, you know, how you might behave amongst your friends is different than how you might behave with your family or with people you knew for 20 years or people you just met. Regardless of how close you are to any given people, you sort of have a different way of being. And the film is much more aggressive than that in terms of at any given point, people know that they're putting up a false front or they know they're withholding something, but it very much gets at kind of the role that, you know, I was going to say masks, but masks are very prevalent in society right now, but the way that certain personas take on different roles and reveal different things about ourselves, even if we think we're hiding something, we might actually be revealing something else entirely. I do want to call it the third story, not only because it is certainly the most touching of the three and kind of clarifies a lot of the thematic elements that have been going on in the other two, but it was also, so the sort of architecture, the background of the setting in which it takes place is that there was some huge like internet virus that caused the world to just shut down the internet. It became too dangerous for the internet to operate because it was too easy to steal people's personal information. It just became a huge security risk. So everything shut down. And so society has regressed to just using more analog forms of communication. And it really in an accidental way, because he wrote that story before the pandemic hit, but became this incredibly moving reflection on the past 2 years as a reversal. So whereas our experience in the past few years has been super isolated, we can only communicate with each other over Zoom meetings like this. Here they can only communicate face to face. And there's still the same kind of cutoff that happened. You know, certain people in work sectors weren't able to continue doing their jobs, but got different benefits as a result of that. People are kind of refinding their way through life with this kind of foundational element removed from it. And, you know, whereas a film like Bad Luck Bang is a very aggressively pandemic era film, something like the third section of Wheel of Fortune Fantasy becomes like a sort of more tepid reaction, not tepid, but more subtextual reaction to the moment.
I'll mostly keep my thoughts to myself because listeners will have just heard me talk about this movie on the Movie Journal, the most recent Movie Journal. But I did want to point out in the like little text that the third one you're talking about having taking place in like an alternate present where the internet has been shut down or whatever. I found it interesting that the text describing that happening goes out of its way to mention that at the point the story takes place, no one is sure yet whether this is a temporary change.
Oh yeah.
Or like, because that also, I think, speaks to the deep pandemic anxiety of like, is this the new normal or will we get back to normal? You know,
yeah,
they're canceling Sundance again, that sort of thing. But I will also say, cause obviously I've got 2 months until I have to firm up my top 10 list, but I will say that Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy also ranks higher than Drive My Car for me, but I did love both movies.
Right on. All right. Number six, let's take a turn towards some more mainstreamy stuff. Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, which I certainly was not expecting to love as much as I did. For me, when I discovered Edgar Wright, same time as everyone else, you know, saw Shaun of the Dead, it was right at the end of high school, my senior year, and I was completely obsessed. I watched that and Spaced over and over and over again. It was a huge, huge film for me. When they did like a little roadshow of Hot Fuzz before it came out, they kind of toured around the country to various art house theaters. I was there for that. Got my Spaced disc signed by Simon Pegg. And Scott Pilgrim, you know, I'm huge. You know, that movie came out when I was 24. So it was definitely speaking to that whole time of being a millennial and very much a voice of a generation kind of stuff. I've found his work to be kind of diminishing returns ever since. You know, I liked At World's End and did not really care for Baby Driver that much. I thought it was really
the World's End.
Right. There were like 500 World's End movies that year, and I never remember which order the various words go in.
At World's End is the Pirates of the Caribbean movie, right?
Yes, that's right. Which I have seen more recently and do like more than The World's End.
Yeah, I love them both. Both great movies.
So, and just between that and between him switching into a full on horror genre here, I wasn't sure he could get rid of his kind of innate cleverness enough to really embrace kind of a full on horror picture show. And I think he completely does here. Fundamentally, there's just a lot of stuff on here that I just really get off on. That whole sequence where they're, so it's about a woman who, a young woman who's going to fashion school in London, living in the Soho neighborhood, and has a great affection for the 1960s. And then she falls asleep one night and wakes up in the 1960s. And she's sort of following slash taking on the role of a young woman in that time and perceiving the era, at least through her vision. Even if sometimes she's embodying her, sometimes she's kind of standing outside of her. It's very much like a dream in which you're kind of participating in events, not completely in control of them, and sometimes just observing them. So the first sequence where she goes into the past and that song "You're My World" is playing in the background, she starts it kind of on cheap record player, and then that's when the film takes over in the surround sound channels and just envelops the auditorium. And Thomas McKenzie, who plays the young woman, is walking down the stairs and gradually perceiving herself to be Anya Taylor-Joy, and there's all these multi-mirrored effects going on, and then the song transitions to be a live singer, and like that is completely my shit. I love huge directorial swings like that, and there are a number of things like that that Edgar Wright is just letting loose on an aesthetic level that's just totally thrilling. I also think it's a lot more subversive and interesting than people are making it out to be. I think people are kind of writing off the ending, which I'll get to in a second without spoiling things. Writing off the ending is far more simplistic than it is. But along the way, there's some really subversive uses of kind of classic hits. There's a lot of music in this film, which I've been listening to constantly. It's a great, great playlist. Just the fact that later on in the film, Ellie, that's the young girl's name that Thomas McKenzie plays, she starts getting kind of haunted by these ghosts. And at one point when she's being chased by them, he sets it to "Always Something There to Remind Me," which is kind of darkly funny. And then he uses "Land of a Thousand Dances," which is a total banger as just a nightmare song while Sandy is going out night after night. Sandy is the girl in the past who Ellie is kind of following. As Sandy goes out night after night being preyed on men, the Thousand Dances being very much just like night after night of going at dances, and each one of them more miserable than the last. And then the ending, which again, I'll be vague about, but I think it's even more subversive than Wright is necessarily intending it to be, because it kind of presents a resolution and emotional catharsis where it's actually Ellie becoming more and more deeply associated with the past in a dangerous way, and kind of speaks to, I think, a tendency a lot of us have, which is once we've decided who a victim in a given situation is, we can forgive almost anything. And I think there's something kind of disturbing about that and kind of dark in the happy way in which Edgar Wright starts to present it as it reaches its final minutes. So that's as clarifying as I can be without giving it all away.
Yeah, I think you just, because I liked Last Night in Soho, I think you just talked me into liking it a little bit more. I will definitely, here's how, I mean, this shouldn't be a surprise, it's an Edgar Wright movie. There's like, this will definitely come up, this movie, when Tyler and I and Sean do our now annual Needle Drops episode in late February. But the like three that I have on my, you named like four or five songs. The three that I have on my list aren't even in. That's how many Needle Drops.
Yeah, there's a lot
great
of
Needle Drops there are in this movie I have more than you even mentioned.
Is Puppet on a String one of them?
No.
Oh man, that was another moment where I was like, yes, this is. This is working for me. All right. Where the hell am I? Number five. This is the one I probably have the least to say about because I've only seen it once, and it's a fairly simple film in some ways, at least presentationally. It's Celine Sciamma's Petite Maman. I also liked Portrait of Lady on Fire, her last film, and kind of the one that made her a lot. We talked about this on the AFI Fest episode,
yeah, we did.
But there's a certain showiness to it that is at once impressive and a little like, yeah, okay, that's cool. Petite Maman is a super accomplished, very confident film in its simplicity. It's like 70 minute film, maybe 75 minutes, about a young girl who her grandmother just died, and she and her parents go move into the grandmother's house to kind of clean it out and clean up and all that stuff you have to do after someone passes away. And then becomes a window into her family's history and just learning a great deal about the world in which she comes from through a very clever device that I will not specify further here. But it's just such a lovely film about childhood. And I mostly do not care for movies about childhood. I don't know. Maybe I just don't think about my childhood enough and just don't care. But in general, films about children are just like, okay, next. So I wasn't expecting to love this one as much as I do, but it's so imaginative in its conceit and specifically textured to this family, and just every element of it is so well put together. It's beautifully shot. Claire Mathon returns, same cinematographer, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, so not too surprising that it looks as good as it does. She also shot, I was looking this up yesterday, Stranger by the Lake, Atlantix, and Spencer, so she's a hell of a cinematographer. And just to see this much talent on what is, you know, architecturally a fairly simple story and this much emotion drawn out of it, I was just incredibly moved by it. And it's one I saw on like a terrible screener copy too. I wasn't expecting to be so blown away by it aesthetically.
Oh, you did. So you didn't, I forgot that you didn't see it in the theater at AFI.
No, I did not.
Like I did.
I wish I had now.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about an AFI Fest, and you said you made a comparison that, I've since heard other people also make of comparing it to The Red Balloon, of being like movie that is like not necessarily what you think of as a kid's movie, but could definitely pass as a kid's movie, of being like, it's what, 71 minutes long or something like that. And it's about like, you know, cute, like young tykes or whatever, but it has that feeling of you could show this to a kid as long as they speak French or read subtitles.
Yeah. Or young enough to not understand anything.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Number four is Emma Seligman's Shiva Baby. I got to shout out my lovely wife, Julie, for introducing me to this film. She picked this out of, so we saw this last year, or sorry, 2 years ago in late 2020 at one of the mini film festivals that was screening online. I think this was Outfest specifically. Didn't watch anything else as part of that festival. She was just like, this movie looks great. We should totally see it. And it was totally great. And I'm so glad we saw it. I've seen it again since. And usually, you know, there's a couple films on this list that I considered after first seeing them because I found them super funny, but kind of revisiting them later, didn't find them to be as engaging in that regard. I watched this again and could not stop laughing all over again at exactly the same things I laughed at the first time. Fred Melamed finally seeing a tray of desserts and going, ooh, desserts, and wandering off. Just the best.
Yeah, Fred Melamed's awesome. Friend of the show and great in the movie.
And it's funny in a way that just keeps twisting the knife of discomfort. So the film has been most frequently described as kind of about a young woman who's working as a sugar baby, which, like, I'm unclear about the designations of various sex work. I'm taking the film at its term. Essentially, she does have sex for money, and they kind of put her up in this nice apartment.
But she has one client. I think that's the difference between a sugar baby and a prostitute.
I thought so too. But then we see later in the film her getting notifications on an app saying, like, let's meet up.
Oh, I must have missed that. Okay.
Because that's, I mean, how
that's
another
just
character
for fun.
That's how another character finds out about her doing this work, is they send the notifications on her phone. So again, I'm not trying to like argue with anyone's definitions. I just don't understand. But anyway, so it's she meets one of her clients at a Shiva service. Unexpectedly, it turns out that he used to work for her father, and she's just kind of been dragged along as a family event. Rather humorously, I don't think the film ever clarifies who the Shiva is for. And there's a lot of repeat questions about why they're there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's really a collision of everything that this young woman, Danielle, played by Rachel Sennett, is going through. It's her strained relationship with her ex-girlfriend, who was a childhood friend that they became kind of involved in high school and become estranged since then. It's about her aimlessness as she approaches college graduation, her body image issues, all this stuff coming down to bear on this one event inside of a, again, very short film, definitely less than 80 minutes. And I really can't remember the last debut feature that managed an ensemble this large, there's easily a dozen roles that have like a definitive, distinct effect on the film. And every one of them comes up fleshed out, specifically acted and given a lot of thought and care to them. And like I said, with Lost Daughter, I feel like most debut features are contentious, focus on one or two actors. That's enough for their concern. But Seligman really gives a lot of attention to every corner of this world, which is all the better to bear on kind of the anxiety ridden effect it's having on Danielle. Someone on Twitter accurately described the film, well, at least from my perception, as uncut gem for hot Jewish sluts. And it has the same kind of sense of just pervasive anxiety and dread that every interaction will just make life a little bit worse for her. And yeah, I mean, above all, it is just incredibly funny.
Yeah, it's great. But it's also been forever since I saw it. Not quite as long as you, but yeah. It's great and very funny. Glee's Diana Agron is one of those crucial roles. I love to see Quinn from Glee showing up.
Big fan of, I can't think of, she was in some terrible blockbuster, like The Fourth Man or The Fourth
Guy. I Am Number Four.
Yeah. I'm Number Four fan.
With Alex Pettifer, right?
That sounds about right. What happened to that guy?
I kept seeing him in things that were meant to be like, here we go. And then it just never happened. But he's like, exactly. And he was officially our lead in Magic Mike. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's like, there were stories, I think, that he later copped to of him being like very difficult on Magic Mike and maybe other things. And I think maybe the reason he copped to it is because the stories of his behavior started costing him work. And that's why we don't see him in things. But I've not seen him in anything in quite some time.
I did mean to mention where these films are available. Most of them so far have been VOD or coming soon to theaters. But Shiva Baby, you can just watch on HBO Max. So I know a lot of people subscribe to that. So it's easily accessible there. All right. Number three is definitely a film that was at one time my number one. I can never know his name. Joachim Trier's Worst Person in the World. This was another film we talked about.
Well, it's Scandinavian, so it's probably more of a yo, like,
oh yeah,
so it's called like Joachim Trier, something like that. Joachim, something like that.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Another film we talked about from AFI Fest. This will be in a more wide release. It did, you know, kind of a qualifying run, but it'll come out in theaters more properly next month. Just a super invigorating portrait of the present. I'm not going to say it's as good as like a La Dolce Vita, but it gave me the same sensation as La Dolce Vita of having these kind of isolated chapters that kind of form a whole portrait without necessarily connecting the precise space between the two. There are some threads that are left kind of unresolved, some that come back at the very end of the film, and some that kind of carry on through the course of it. But just kind of give a way to view the course of this young woman's life who becomes kind of a stand-in for a lot of, I think, anxiety for people around her age, which is frankly around my age. It takes place over three or four years. I think she roughly from 25 to 30, I think she'd say she is.
She talks about turning 30 in the movie. So I think.
Right. But I'm trying to remember when that is.
That's one of the middle chapters. Yeah. So I feel like she's late 20s, early 30s for most of the movie.
Okay.
That was important, right?
Super important. It's told in 12 chapters in a prologue. The prologue is this super fast, super funny narration showing as she's gone through school, switching majors constantly, can't decide what she wants to do. And it kind of is a clever way to introduce the fact that, yeah, this movie's going to be dramatic. It's about relationships building up, falling apart. But it's also going to have a lot of great humor in it, which it totally does. And there are sequences in it that mix the two totally expertly. There's a breakup scene that's unbelievably moving and also hilarious from time to time. It has one of the sexiest scenes I've seen in certainly all year, maybe in years, that has no sex in it at all. It's explicitly about two characters trying not to cheat on their respective significant others and trying to do everything they can that doesn't technically qualify as cheating, but is just so romantic. It's got others that are pretty much throwaway jokes. You know, there's a chapter titled Oral Sex in the Age of Me Too. That's just about her writing an essay titled that. And yeah, I mean, I guess without giving away where it ends up, which is a much more melodramatic turn, that I understand I understand why people aren't as on board with it, those who didn't care for the film, but I think it works very well and was very moving. Yeah, the film just had me from the opening shot. Literally, the opening shot is a complete stunner, and I was totally thrilled with it.
I'll hold my tongue for the most part, because listeners will have heard me just heard me talk about it on the Movie General, because it'll probably be the last movie I talk about, because it's the last movie I've watched.
And I know if you liked it.
It is monumental.
Okay. Yeah.
And especially as someone who's been a Joachim Trier agnostic. I haven't seen Also the August 31st. I know that's like,
oh, you would dig it.
Yeah, that's supposed to be the big one. But I had seen Louder Than Bombs and didn't care for it. And then I liked Thelma, so I was like, all right, but this doesn't feel like either of those movies in most ways. But
I mean I like Louder Than Bombs more than you. I wasn't as into Thelma, but this is much more similar to Also August 31, I think. Or Reprise, his first two films. So I definitely recommend you go back to check those out, because they're much, much better than his last two films. Even though I definitely would say The Worst Person in the World is his best film so far. It's his most ambitious and I think most accomplished in a lot of ways. And there's something about the fact that it centers around a woman that adds a certain dynamic to it. The Reprise and Also August 31 are very male films, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it adds a different kind of dynamic and perspective to it. He co-wrote the script with another guy, but they kind of ran it by the lead actress, whose name I will summarily butcher, something like Renette Rensvi. They kind of ran it by her to kind of get a pass on getting her perspective, seeing if she would express things differently. And so it's a good reflection on what the right kind of actor can bring to a role. I mean, she's giving, for my money, the performance of the year in the lead role here, accomplishing so much. Like I said, for the film shifting tones for her to center her character that well. And she's not a first time actress, but she's never had a role this big before. So it's really impressive. And I look forward to seeing more from her.
And I'm always happy to see Anders Danielsson Lee, if that's how you say his name, who was in this movie and Bergman Island this year.
Well, speaking of which,
holy shit,
Bergman Island.
Whoa.
Holy shit.
What a fantastic transition.
I know, nailed it. I had a very kind of David Bax attitude going into this, which was like, I love Mia Hansen-Love. I think she's one of the best filmmakers working today. Of course, Ingmar Bergman is my favorite filmmaker of all time. So I was like, all right, film, let's see. Don't know about this.
Hang on now. So you're saying that the David Bax approach is skepticism pessimism?
What he's saying, well, first off, the thing that he's saying is that Scott listens to me more than you do.
For sure.
But I have repeatedly said that the more something feels tailored to my
tastes,
the more suspicious I
absolutely
I am of it.
It is I think a good way to approach things. Yes.
Yeah. But I really got kind of that thrill you get when you hear like there's a cover of a song you love by an artist you love, but you don't think it can add anything new, but then it does. And you're like, oh shit, this is just as good as the original. But gives you something different from that. So like
when Scarlett Johansson did those Tom Waits covers, I hear you.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm referring to. So this is a film about two coupled filmmakers. I don't know if it's clarified that they're married. The reason I'm suspicious that they are is because it's very nakedly based on Mia Hansen-Love's own relationship with Olivier Assayas, and they were never married. Vicky Creeps and Tim Roth play the couple here, and they are traveling to the island of Faro, which is where Ingmar Bergman lived and worked for most of at least the second half of his life. I think he finally moved there in the 60s. And I'm trying to think of how old he would have been by the end of it, but I'd say around half of his life. And in the years since his death, it's kind of turned to like a weird tiny amusement park in honor of Ingmar Bergman. It has this annual, or at least pre-pandemic, had an annual kind of Bergman festival where people from all over the world come together to gather and discuss his films. And I wasn't aware of it. The film depicts a Bergman safari where they hop on a school bus and tour around locations on Faro where they shot different scenes from his films, and kind of give some context to that. And the locals are, as one would expect, different levels of interested in the legacy Bergman has left on the island and the fact that people only come there for him. But Hansen Love gives a completely different vision of Faro than Ingmar Bergman ever did. For Bergman, it was dark and depressing and horrible, and that's why he loved it. But it's this like glorious summer film of like people going out swimming and bathing in the sun and having these great meals outdoors. And it's very like lovely and gorgeous. And Tim Roth kind of, when Vicky Krieps comments on this, Tim Roth jokingly says, try this place in fucking January, which is one of Tim Roth's many great kind of pithy lines. And then it has this whole narrative conceit where it completely switches stories. It goes into a film that Vicky Krieps is developing and kind of reveals the shooting of that in some ways, starring Mia Wasikowska. And rather than feel like it was two ideas that me, Hansen Love just kind of mashed together, it feels like both are kind of natural extensions of the other, and a great way to explore the thematic concerns, the emotional concerns that she has, and everything else that she's gone through. I mean, Mia Hansen Love's films have always been deeply personal, often very nakedly autobiographical, either about her or in the case of Eden, it's directly based on her brother's life. This is by far her most autobiographical in terms of the details of it, and loses none of kind of the personal touches and the outsider perspective and the way she interrogates her characters and lets them enjoy life and suffer a little bit. And it's just a really lovely, totally accomplished film that gave me so much more than I was expecting from it.
I also absolutely loved it. And it is also, I'm not going to spoil my list because it hasn't been finalized yet, but it is also in close proximity to The Worst Person in the World, because they do both feel like movies that are, I guess, and this is something that I associate with Bergman, is an understanding of the world in which the cerebral and the physical or the somatic exist at the same time. You can't you can't separate one. So there's like an irony to the fact that this couple has, like, you're seeing maybe some cracks in their not marriage. I think I maybe just did the like American assumption of like, oh, look, they're together and they have children, they must be married. I was told when I was 7 years old, that's how it works. But you see the cracks forming at the same time that they're in this like beautiful sun-dappled location. Speaking of locations, I'm sure you're way more of a Bergman head than I am, the biggest Bergman head I know. So I enjoy it. Like, there are locations in the movie that are specifically called out. Like, this is the house from Scenes from a Marriage, and this is the jetty or whatever from Through a Glass Darkly. But I also was like, wait, that's the house from Passion of Anna, right? Like, I feel like I saw other things. Did you catch other things, other Bergman references that weren't called out by the movie?
Yeah, I feel like I saw some, sounds really vague, but some specific rock formations that looked familiar from Persona. Houses, I'm just bad with architecture. Houses, I'm just like, it's a building, whatever.
But doesn't, like, Passion of Anna literally begins with Max von Sydow like working on his rooftop. So it starts with the shot of the house, if I'm remembering Passion of Anna right. So I'm pretty sure that we see that house in the movie in Bergman Island as well.
All right. Also a great clothes movie. Everyone here super well dressed, looks like a lot of fun to hang out in those clothes in that environment.
Yeah.
All right. Number one, West Side Story. No surprise for anyone who knows me at all. I've been a completely bowled over by this movie. I've seen it 4 times in theaters already. I'm probably going again next week. I keep waiting for it to run its course with me, but I keep wanting to see it again as soon as it finishes. There's a lot of reasons why it's my favorite film of the year. Maybe the biggest is that I just think the musical in general is kind of maybe not the ultimate form of cinema, but a place where it definitely reaches its fullest potential. And it's so incredibly rare that it does. I've been consistently going to movies for 20 years. I haven't seen a musical this good in that entire time. I haven't seen the musical form explored this dynamically and this elaborately in that entire time. They're usually jobs shoved off to music video directors who cut too much, who don't have a sense of the elegance of the human body and how it can interact with the camera and how it can tell the story along with it. I think of like the Rob Marshall school of cutting, where it's half shooting the behind the scenes vision of the movie and half giving you the movie itself. This is very much musical geared towards the camera. I'm coming from a place of thinking that Stanley Donen is one of the 10 greatest directors of all time. So for someone to make a great musical is as good as it gets for me. And beyond that, so I'm watching the film, I'm feeling the rhythm that Spielberg's introducing, right from the jump, the opening kind of Sharks versus Jets number where the people are dancing through the streets and the camera's gliding around. I'm like, okay, all right. I'm impressed. I wasn't expecting to love this film because of how frequently I'm disappointed in musicals these days. But I was like, okay, you got my attention. And then we get to the gym and he's really cutting loose and operating on a different level. And the way the characters are introduced throughout the whole kind of tango number. And then each other from across the gym and they're being spotlighted both directly and the lighting is absolutely on fire throughout the film. They're seeing each other and the lights are spotlighting them. The performers are moving in such a way that highlights them without kind of like forming a circle of them or anything, but just through the sheer movement, our eyes are still drawn to them. And the lights come on behind her. And I'm seeing something from Spielberg that I haven't seen him do. I don't know if ever, which is just watch two people fall in love. Spielberg, for all his many talents, typically does not do love stories very well at all. Has almost no interest in sex or kind of emotional attractions or anything like that. Romance is not his forte, but here there's just two young people completely earnestly falling in love. I get the criticisms people have had about Ansel Elgort and Rachel Zegler's chemistry. I don't know that I agree. I think a lot of young people have kind of uneasy feelings about love and senses of chemistry and senses of building themselves up and posing for each other and trying to be a certain way and getting caught off guard by the way that love makes you uneasy and makes you uncomfortable and makes you vulnerable in certain ways. I get that Elgort's a little stiff, but again, I'm a big musical fan. I'm used to the occasional stiff performer in a lead role. It doesn't really bother me that much. But I also know this type of guy who's like I said, posing for people in a certain way and is using love kind of as an extension of his own needs. I buy that Tony's going through something new and different in his life that he can't really give himself over to and is still trying to remain the cool, tough guy. And I absolutely love Rachel Zegler in the film. I think she's incredible and has a magnificent voice and really marries that voice into the dramatic work in a way that I don't want to get into too many comparisons with the original West Side Story, both because I love the film and because I love this one a good deal more. I don't want to make it sound like I'm putting that film down, but because Maria was dubbed in the original film, we never got that kind of sense of a continuous character. It's all Rachel Zegler here and she nails it, and I adore Ariana DeBose as Anita and David Alvarez as Bernardo, and especially Mike Fast as Riff, who's so fresh and so invigorating. And every performance here is just super keyed in and super invested in the material. And then the more I've seen it, kind of the more I've figured out this whole other layer to it. So the big thing that Tony Kushner added to it is a very concrete reality that whatever the result of these like gang wars is, the entire block is going to be torn down. So they're fighting with each other over a crumbling neighborhood that's going to be demolished, that's going to be useless in a couple of years, but it's still their territory. That's what matters to them. And so they're fighting each other instead of fighting to retain the neighborhood at all. And they're trying to make Brent from day to day and trying to make another day, even though there's no future ahead of them. And, you know, frankly, after 2 years of going to work every day and trying to make the best of pandemic life, going out with friends and going on small weekend trips and trying to make the best of what feels at times like a crumbling, crumbling world, and not really, you know, sometimes ignoring that crumbling world, sometimes coming face to face with it, but really focusing in on the moment. I felt like the film captures that same emotional essence. And so to see something, you know, as pure and celebratory inflicted as the way they stage America, I almost never cry at the movies, but of all scenes, that scene, as soon as it starts and Ariana DeBose is walking down the street with her friends and giving each other that little smile, that scene got me every time. I was a mess during it. I don't usually cry at like super sad stuff in movies, but super beautiful, happy, emotional expressions. That's my shit completely. Yeah, I completely loved West Side Story in a way that I wasn't expecting to, in a way that most films, I mean, you know, I have a number one film every year that I love, but every now and again, there's one that's a different tier. And this is up there with The Master or No Home Movie. You know, I haven't been this affected, I think, by a movie since No Home Movie at all. And by a mainstream film, I mean, it's been by a film that's gotten, you know, 3,000 plus theater release. It's been over a decade since something has been this enrapturing. Yeah.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, story. If it makes you feel any better, the film has not done well. Yeah, it's right. Done as well as a film with maybe 10 theaters. So, know. You know, you it's can depressing. Cling to that if you like.
Yeah. It's yeah. depressing.
I also like West Side Story. I've already aired my little my hangups before. What I do want to address is you I'm glad that you have the confidence to boldly say that you like this movie better than Robert Wise's movie and Jerome Robbins' movie, because I think that's been a big hangup for me, is like it feels like such a sacred cow to me, because I love that movie so much that I've been focused. I've focused, I think, a little bit too much my energy on the things that I don't like as much as the earlier version. So I will say, I'll go ahead and say, you know, I like that Spielberg staged like most of the musical numbers in different locations and stuff than Robert Wise did. And I will say unequivocally that the changes made to the song Cool, both how it's staged
yeah.
and where it is in the story, which is a completely different place than it is in Robert Wise's story, is better. It's absolutely better than the 1961 movie. So there, you got that out of me.
Oh, another thing is I'm glad they didn't add some bullshit song just to get a best Oscar nomination.
Yes.
Or a best song nomination. They just, yeah. they filmed the play and that's good enough.
Yeah. But yeah, I think your list really, because there are movies that I think are amazing that I know you have seen and liked that aren't in your top 10. And yet I don't really have any, I can't like argue with you. That's how
it's a strong enough year.
This has been a very strong year. And I think part of it is because we're getting a year plus worth of movies.
For sure.
You know, that's why it's such a strong year.
Yeah. I mean, West Side Story was supposed to come out a year ago.
Yeah. And so 2022 might be the same because we're getting more overflow. So this might be 2 years in a row of a bounty for us movie lovers. But yeah, fantastic year and great list. I think had I seen everyone? I think I'd seen all of your top 10.
Oh, wild. Usually I stump you with something.
Because I think I had something to say about everyone.
Yeah, I think you're right. Looking back through it.
Yeah, well, you stumped me with PBT chat. I didn't know. I didn't know about that one. So you,
I
that
almost was included mention. A French documentary about a guy in isolation watching 400 movies and narrating little clips of them. Great movie.
Just don't think I'll scream. Okay. All right. Well, this is fun. This is it's fun because I love talking about all the great movies that. That have come out recently, but also it's fun because this is kind of us kicking off.
This is the kickoff, right?
Yeah, this is kicking off like 2.5 months of us wrapping up the end of the year. I mean, there'll be not every episode, you know, we'll be doing a few. It'll be a while before we get back to podcasts about the end of the year. It'll be till we do Needle Drops in late February, but we should have, I hope I'm not overpromising, we should have. The website should have Scott mentioned doing a written version of his list. We should have some other lists from other contributors. Yeah. So there should be between the podcast and the website, battleshipretention.com. There should be A lot of content. I just did it. I said content. God damn it.
It's hard not to.
It's like when I say whether or not something is a thing. I like have said spent so long resisting that, but it's just become part of the fabric of the lexicon. So much so that a fucking character says in Spielberg's West Side Story, that's not even a thing. And I was like, what? People weren't talking that way back then, but it doesn't matter. It's just how people talk now, and it just seems like it's, I got to stop fighting it. Anyway, there'll be a lot of stuff about the end of the year on the podcast, and some of it we'll do the BPs on the Patreon. Check out patreon.com/battleshippretension. In the meantime, you can find reviews of a lot of these movies that, that Scott talked about today at battleshippretension.com. You can follow me on David on Twitter at Davey Pretension. Also check out my other podcast, the one where I met your mother, where my wife Natalie and I watch an episode of Friends and an episode of How I Met Your Mother every week. This most recent one we got to, I guess, spoilers for people who are even more in the dark than me about Friends, the episode where Rachel and Ross first kiss. And then we got to one of the all-time funniest How I Met Your Mother episodes, which is called Swarly.
Even I know about that one.
Yeah. So that was a really good, really fun episode to talk about. You can email me david@battleshippretention.com. Tyler is on Twitter at Tyler Pretension. Email him at tyler@battleshippretention.com. What do you have to plug, Tyler?
Nothing.
And Scott, where can people find more thoughts about these movies? I'm sure you'll be tweeting about the next time you go to see West Side Story.
Oh, of course. Something new will pop out. It's a multi-textured film.
Well, you know what's going to come up next time you see West Side Story? Omicron. You are going to get COVID.
There's nobody at the movies.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's the safest place.
Is that why you've been seeing West Side Story so many times? Because you know.
Yeah, complete isolation.
Yeah, I'm not trying, by the way, when I say that, I should say, I'm not trying to bash the movie at all. I don't like anybody who says, like, it's like, oh, well, it's a bomb. It's like, who gives a shit? Like, if it's great, I mean, obviously you want it to do well, but at the same time, like, that's not a value judgment on the film that I'm pointing
out. No, I know. The only drag with it is it's such a great audience film. The first time I saw it was at a full, like, industry screening, and everyone was, like, on fire at the end of it and couldn't stop talking about it. And, like, that's also always super exciting, especially for a musical, and people do the involuntary thing of, like, clapping at the numbers, which is dumb, but you can't help doing it because you're so energized.
I can help it.
Good for you. The screenings have been pretty fairly well attended. They haven't been the emptiest theaters I've been to by far. Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, me and one other woman, we were just having the time of our life. I thought I could go mask off for the movie because I was like, just Scott, but this other woman had to come in, ruin it all.
And she sat 5.5 feet away from me. Damn it. Yeah.
I was getting my measuring tape out.
Did you say your Twitter?
No, I didn't. Twitter, Rail of Tomorrow. I ran down my favorite discoveries of the last year. I picked out like 52 movies and just kind of listed them with some screen caps. They're all fine movies. And try to post reviews frequently-ish on Letterboxd. I'll post, like I said, written version of this list for Battleship Retention. I'm also considering maybe doing a list of the best French films of the year. I've seen all but 5 of the films that have gotten theatrical releases, as far as I can tell from my research. So if I can see those last 5 in the next couple of weeks, I'll run down a list of them.
That'd be exciting. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Scott, for blessing us with your top 10 list.
Oh, thanks always for having me. I enjoy putting this together. Even it caused me some stress this week of like, I can't leave this off. Oh, well, I did. Oh, well.
Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.